But today we are talking about conceptual modeling. So, conceptual modeling. Anybody knows the words? Heard those words? So, conceptual modeling is the activity that you do as a designer to create sort of the conceptual model of your interface, meaning sort of the overall organization of the interface, how the principles on which it is based. It's not yet designing the wireframes or even coding anything. I know that for many people in industry, even in academia sometimes, designing means doing wireframes with one of these tools or others. I think this is a dangerous practice. I think you have to think a little bit before you get into doing these things. And now you can sketch interfaces, you can sketch ideas and all that, but the success of your interface will depend on whether it has a good conceptual model. So this is what we're going to try to talk about today. So before we get to the conceptual model, I'll have to talk about Bill Norman, about affordances and metaphors, and then we'll get to the meat of the lecture. So I've talked about Bill Norman before, you remember? Bill Norman, yes. What did I say about that?
Objects in general, he said that the main concepts were that they should be discoverable, and they should tell you their function without needing a sign or something like that.
Yes, except this is not what I talked about. So you got that from someone else, which is correct.
Yeah.
That's fine. That's what we'll get to today. But I talked about Doug Norman before. Design guidelines? Not in this class, not yet. There was a diagram. Something theory. Something called action theory. Now I remember the last. Yes? Yeah, I'm not talking about this. I'm talking about when did I speak about Doug Norman before in this class? You don't know. Nobody was here. Okay, well, you go back to your slides and you figure it out. So Doug Norman authored, as I have said before, is originally a cognitive psychologist. And he got interested in user interfaces, let's say. And he wrote this book after he went for a, what in academia we call a sabbatical year, where you, normally every 7 years, you have the right to sort of not take a year off, as sabbatical would imply, but take a year off teaching, so you can typically travel to visit other research centers and laboratories and spend more time on your research. And so he went to England. He wanted to go to Europe, and he went to England because he thought it would be easier because it's English-speaking, like the U.S. And then he arrived in England, and he realized that a lot of things didn't work as expected. Has anybody visited England or been in England or lived in England? Yes? So have you experienced some everyday frustrations with the way things work? Yes? Okay, so showers. Something else? You had? You were going to say something.
Where at?
Hmm?
Oh, I can say something.
No, I think you were.
Yeah, I was going to talk about the shower, but I'm not sure if it was my case or if it was general. You turn the knob in the other way, than the normal way in the theory. Okay.
Exactly, so that's one issue. There's the same thing with locks.
You
have to turn the key the other way. But then I think, you know, they also drive on the other way. So I don't know, I think the channel has created a vortex where things get inverted. So the thing is that there's all these things we take for granted, right? The way you use a shower, the way you open the door, etc. And so that made him think and reflect on this notion of how do you know how to operate a device? So he had met with James Gibson. Do you remember Gibson? Did I teach the same group of people here or what? I'm really, this is very discouraging. James Gibson. What did I talk about James Gibson? In the first slide of Psychology 101. I talk about the theory of affordances and ecological psychology and all that. Okay, go back to your slides and your notes. So he had met with Gibson, who had visited him in San Diego, and they had talked about affordances. If you remember, or apparently since you don't remember, the notion of affordance by Gibson is the abilities that objects have in the world. And so Norman translated that to the way we interact in the world every day and how we know how to operate the door handle, the washing machine, a telephone, all these everyday devices. And introduced to HCI these notions of affordance, of metaphor, and conceptual model in this book, which originally was called The Psychology of Everyday Things, because he was a psychologist, experimental psychologist, or cognitive psychologist, and his first book was a serious academic book, The Psychology of Everyday Things, which was in some corner of bookstores. And when it got re-edited, his publisher, I believe, said, well, you know, we should have a more fancy title. And they call it The Design of Everyday Things. And then he went from the, you know, dusty psychology section of bookstores into the more fancy design section, and has been the best seller. And Don Norman has a very nice hatch as a result. Interestingly, after that, Don Norman went to work for Apple. He was the head of the Advanced Technical Group at Apple, which was their research group, which got dissolved when Steve Jobs came back to Apple in 1997 because they were on the brink of bankruptcy. And after that, Norman created his own company with Nielsen, called the Norman Nielsen Group, where they do a lot of consulting. Anyway, all that to say that Don Norman is famous in HCI and beyond. And I think we have a lot to learn from this notion of how do we know how to use an object just by looking at the object. The cover of the book here, of the new edition of the book, is this object. What can you say about this object here? Yes. So, do you know who did that object?
Yep.
Sort of. So there was this artist called Perelman who created a catalog. At the time, there were a lot of catalogs. There was no internet and no web. So people would receive paper catalogs to buy objects. The kind of catalog that you see in, I don't know if you know the SkyMall catalog in airplanes when you fly, yeah? All those weird things. And so he created a parody of these catalogs, and he called it the Catalogue des Objets Introuvables, which means the catalog of objects that are unfindable, don't exist. And all the objects are kind of a weird take on everyday objects. Like this one, which is called a coffee pot for masochists. And so the catalog was made with drawings, and then later on another artist actually turned some of these drawings into physical objects, and there was even an exhibit that was put up and went around the world. This object is on the cover of the book to show that, you know, it doesn't take much to turn something usable into something, let's say, inconvenient, right? And this is really what a lot of the book is about. Now, let's take a concrete and real example. Here's two stoves. So let's say you rent an Airbnb, and it's a common thing these days, and you get the house or apartment you rented, and you are faced with that device. So do you know how to use it? First time you see it. Yes?
You have to read the signs.
You have to read the signs.
Okay, if the signs are not there anymore, you look at the text.
Right, because what are you expecting these buttons to do?
I'm sorry.
It's a stone, so...
More on the left, probably.
Yes. And? Right. Now, if you look carefully, and this is a poor quality picture, but you can imagine if it's an old stove, the signs may have been, you know, washed off over time. But you have tiny icons here, which is essentially four squares, and one of them is white. And it's telling you that indeed this one is mapped, I believe, to this one. This one to this one, this one to this one, this one to this one. Now, if instead you get to a place that has a stove like this,
it's quite easy, but it's not, you know, if you're going to clean, it's quite hard.
So, why is it easier? Yes. What are you going to say? Right. So the four buttons here roughly match the layout of these. So your immediate assumption is that this button is controlling this. Now maybe it's not. People design this really. Sneaky, but yes, so there is a direct mapping. Right. Now, we were talking about showers before. So, to control the water in a shower, you typically have two types of systems. Right? So, you have a system where you control how much hot water and how much cold water you get, right, with the hot button and the cold button. And then you have a system where you control how much water and
proportion between the hot water and
usually it's labeled as a temperature, right? Yes. So when you take a shower, you prefer to control amount of water and temperature. Or do you prefer to control amount of cold water and amount of hot water?
First one.
Why is that?
Because becomes more and more organized.
One action.
But also, if you are, you know, sensitive to temperature, you want to set the temperature and then maybe vary the amount of water. Whereas with the second solution, every time you, if you want to make the water hotter, you also get more water at the same time. So it's not independent variables in your mental model of a shower. Now, in the mental model of the plumber, of course, you have one hot water pipe and one cold water pipe, so the second solution is a lot easier. You put a tap on each kind of water. So when we talk about, when I talked about affordances and the way they were described by Gibson, Gibson was interested in the way we perceive the physical world, not necessarily the way we operate these more complex devices like showers and soaps. And so he defined the notion of affordance, and that's a quote from his book, saying the affordances of the environment are what it offers the animal, and the animal can be a human, what it provides or furnishes, either for good or ill. And so here what it says is an affordance is a property of the environment relative to the animal. So, as I've said before, if I see an object that has a certain height and appears to be made of a certain material, it has a property that I could call sittability. I can sit on it. And the fact that I can sit on it and the object will sustain my weight, it depends on what it's made out of. So the environment has its property, but something that is perceived as suitable for me will not be perceived as suitable for another, I don't know, for an elephant, because an elephant is much bigger. So what is perceived as suitable for an elephant is different as from me. And so there have been a number of studies that have shown that, yes, we perceive capabilities of objects, like if you give this type of cylinder to someone, they afford rolling it, walking on it, dangerous, and maybe hiding in it if it's big enough. And in fact, studies have been made that when you see an opening in a wall, you immediately know if you can go through it or not. Right? So that's the notion of affordance. Now, this notion of affordance, as defined by Gibson, was misunderstood by Don Norman. And Don Norman used the word affordance, but then later on retracted it and called it signifiers. Because what Don Norman was talking about and what he was interested in is not just the capability of the object for a certain action, but it was whether you do perceive this capability or not. Which, you know, is important. If something has a certain capability, but you don't see it, it's as if it weren't there. So he started to use the word perceived affordances, and then later on he settled, and there's an article in Crash's magazine where he said, sorry, I didn't get it right. Now I'm going to call this signifier. And the signifier is the aspect of an object that you perceive that indicates that this object has a certain capability for action. So in Gibson's notion of affordance, the affordance exists even if it is not perceived, and Norman's notion of affordance later renamed signifier, the affordance exists only if it is perceived. So when you see something that looks like a handle, like a handle on the door, you know, or you assume that you can turn the handle to open the door. In Norman's book, there are a number of examples where you see doors that have the wrong affordances. So, I'm sure you've seen all these glass doors that have a handle on them and have a little sign that says push or that says cool. And no matter what the sign says, people do the wrong thing. Right? Because if you see a bar that you can grab, are you going to push it or are you going to pull it?
Pull.
You pull. He pulls. Everybody pulls? I pull. Most people pull. And if it says push, and no matter how big it says push, and even if it's written in red and with exclamation mark, people will tend to pull. Right? And so if you observe the evolution the way the emergency exit doors are designed now, it's a push bar. It's something that tells you, don't pull me, because it's not something you can hold and pull, you can only push it, right? And that didn't used to be the case, but it was redesigned because people were making mistakes. Which, in a fire emergency, is kind of a problem. So, Von Neumann says that, you know, this is a knowledge that is foundational in our understanding and operating in the world. And this is, I think, from that book. Much of our everyday knowledge resides in the world, not in our heads. Which, for someone who's a cognitive psychologist, is kind of a dramatic statement, because cognitivism tends to say that everything is in the head. So anyway. Now, getting back to Gibson, it bears the question of how do we learn to perceive these opportunities? How do we learn to use objects in the world around us to do our everyday tasks? Now, it turns out that Eleanor Gibson and James Gibson were married, and she was a developmental psychologist. She was studying child development. Babies to others. And she's famous for having created this experiment called the visual cliff. Have we just heard of this? Yeah? So the visual cliff is this experiment here. You have this table with this pattern here. Here there's a piece of glass. You take a baby, small baby that you put on that side on the table. You take the baby's mother and you put her on the other side and you tell the mother, call your baby. And normal babies, they're going to crawl to their mothers. You know, that's part of the basic design of a baby. What's amazing is that a baby, I mean, you see it probably, I don't know, I haven't had babies this size for a long time, so. but a few months, really. I think something like a few months. Some kid can crawl. Won't cross. So by that age, they've already learned the fact that, you know, if you are on a table and you see what she calls a visual cliff, you're not going to go over it. Now, it turns out that this device has the affordance. The glass is strong enough to support the weight of the baby to crawl over to the mother. But the baby does not recognize it because he hasn't had a chance to learn that particular affordance. In fact, even adults have problems with that. Has anybody gone to the CN Tower in Toronto? Yeah? Been at the top? Yeah? So, I don't know how high it is, but sort of Eiffel Tower size, maybe even taller. Yeah, taller. And so at the top there is an observatory, and there's a little section with two squares of pieces of glass. And because the CN Tower is super thin, when you stand there, you know, there's a hole below your feet. And, I mean, you know it's safe. intellectually, you know that they wouldn't put this thing if it were not safe, right? And it's amazing that people who just cannot put their feet on that piece of glass, right? So Ellery Gibson has studied the way we learn to we learn this properties of the world in a sense, and so she has this wonderful saying of we perceive to learn as well as we learn to perceive. So we need to perceive things around us so that we can learn how it works. And if you observe babies, you know, they're going to take an object and drop it and observe that it falls and take another one and drop it. And that's how they learn the rules of the world.
Yeah. Isn't it, for instance, the actual properties of an object?
Well, so that's a whole discussion between Gibson and Norman, right? So according to Gibson, it's the property. And if you don't perceive it, it doesn't matter, the property is still there. Which I think is both useful but insufficient. So I think this idea that not only are the question is whether the property is there or not is important, but also whether you can perceive it. And the thing is that, and I think that's where Eleanor Gibson's work is interesting, is because it says that, you know, we learn what to perceive in an environment that will give us hints about what it can or cannot do. So we learn that, you know, when we have something shaped like a handle, that it's in a particular position, it's supposed to work this way. So if we put this together, in fact, we can draw this diagram crossing affordances with what Norman calls signifiers now. So if the affordance is there, if the capability is there, and you perceive it, well, it's called the perceivable affordance, then all is good. You see the handle, turn the handle, it opens the door. Yeah. Now, if the affordance is not there, the capability is not there, but you still perceive it as being there, well, you're going to be tricked. You're going to think it does something that it doesn't. Like what? Oh, like, yeah. Pockets and women's clothes. Like, you know, the pocket is sewn in, but there's no pocket there. Very good example. Now, the other situation is the affordance is present, the capability is there, but you don't perceive it. So can call this a hidden affordance. These are the tricky one, because especially in software design, you know, you've created a capability and people just want to see that it's there. I gave an example of that earlier in the class with a little icon in the window title of Macintosh Windows, where this little icon next to the name of the window, which you can actually long click and then drag around, almost nobody knows this is there. And that's because you see the icon, but somehow, because it is in the title bar, it doesn't occur to you that it can be manipulated in the same way as a regular icon. So that's a good example of a hidden affordance. And then, if there's no affordance and you don't perceive it, it's a correct rejection, you know. Where nobody gets tricked or frustrated. So the notion of affordances, they operate in a sense at a very sensory perception level. The whole work of Gibson, James Gibson on visual perception is about how our we directly perceive information about the world. But if we sort of get one level up, we can get to the notion of mental model, which is that based on this understanding we have of the world through perceiving its affordances, we build mental models. We build representations in our mind of how things, or how we think things work. So I would define a mental model as an operational representation of the world in one's head, So, for example, if you try to explain to someone who's never been to Paris how to go to Charles de Gaulle Airport to this room here, how are you going to do that? Use a map, use a GPS. No, the person does not have a map or a GPS, so you have to give them instructions. Yes?
Do you use similar things that you have understand? Like transport lines and metros instead of actually going in specific? Because the person will have a mental model in his head, so that just.
Yeah, but if the person has never been to Paris.
Yeah, but like the person will, of course, use buses or will know.
Okay. So you won't tell that person, you know, go find a sign for RERB at the blue line and
but
get on the train.
I don't know about RERB.
Sorry?
But can I know about RERB at the blue line? But the person will know that he has to switch metros.
Yeah.
And once he actually reaches that, he can go to the
train. But if this person has never been in the city, maybe it's like, you know.
Well, how did you, but you know, you should reflect, what did you do the first time you arrived in Paris? Most of you, right? Someone translated their mental model of how to get here into detailed instructions. Now, if you were to explain how to come here to a Parisian, would you use the same instructions? No. Because you assume that... Sorry? Yeah. If the Parisian has never crossed the périphérique, it's a different story. Right. So the point here is you make assumption about what the person already knows. Right. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that we all have representations in our heads of the world around us and how to do certain things. And we communicate with someone, we make assumptions about what this person may or may not know. Right. So the idea of a mental model is that it helps us to make plans and to, you know, do day-to-day tasks. As you come here to campus every day and you discover the problems with buses and trains and all that, well, you adjust your mental model and then you, you know, adjust your timing to be here on time. But also when things break down, you have different, you know, strategies for trying to fix the problem. So you slowly build these structures in your head that the link causes and effects, and that help you to answer questions. Where am I? What can I do now? Why did this happen? I mean, the way you interpret the, I'm sure you become expert if you take the RER to say, well, given the timing that it's showing me, there's something wrong today or not. So you incorporate all this information to create this mental model. And so it supports explanation, what's going on, and it supports prediction. What do I do now? You know, when I walk from my home to the train station, I also have a car that is parked, fortunately, so across the train station. And when I get to the train station, I decide, ooh, it's going to look bad today, so I better take the car. So I make a prediction about whether it's better to stick with the train or take the car. And, of course, sometimes I'm wrong, because taking the car is not always the better choice. And I've been a lot of research on trying to create models for this mental models, objects, actions, state transitions. There's a whole literature of cognitive psychology about mental models. I don't want to get into that because I'm not a specialist, and my personal take on this is that nobody really knows yet. I mean, we have theories about this, but nobody has, you know, gone into the brain and found sufficient evidence. There are various competing models. I think the brain actually works in multiple ways in parallel, so I don't think a single mental model is going to explain everything. But it's important to understand that each person has their own mental model. So when you use a piece of software, now going from the physical world to the digital world, when you use a piece of software, well, whichever software you've used before is going to affect the way you think a new piece of software is working. And so when you design software, you are, you know, in a position of creating mental models in people's heads. So one of the techniques that has been used to facilitate this transition from the physical world, which we are really good at operating in, you know, we do all these complex things every day without even thinking. How can we get software to be as intuitive in a sense? And what I mean by intuitive is that when things work the way you expect them to work, you think it's intuitive. But it's just that you've built the mental model that corresponds to the way things actually work. Right? So how can we make this process happen with software? Because I don't know if you are ever frustrated with software. So I'm frustrated all the time with software. This frustration comes from the fact that you expect it to work in a certain way and it works in a different way. And you cannot, coming back to the previous slide here, you cannot explain why is it doing this thing or not doing this. And therefore you cannot make prediction. How do I go from there and how do I get my work done. So one technique that has been used is the use of a metaphor. I'm sure you've all heard of the desktop metaphor. Yes? Yes? We'll get to this in a second. So a metaphor is a term from rhetoric. It's a figure of speech. So you establish a link between two words, but without explicitly stating why you are making this link. So, if I have a picture of a moon like this, you can say the moon is a golden sickle, so you are here establishing a comparison. You know what a sickle is? Yes, it's a tool to So it has this shape plus a handle. Right. But a direct metaphor is a golden sickle lights the night. So where you don't use the word moon, you don't create the link explicitly. You say golden sickle lights the night. You have to sort of, you know, work in your head. What is lighting the night? It's the moon, the golden sickle, the moon, oh yes, the shape. So, you know, you have to work the comparison. But the reason we do this comparison is usually to transfer relationships from a set of objects to another set of objects. But it does not have to be literal. And that's the important thing about a metaphor. A metaphor, as we use it in today's design, it's not a simulation of the physical thing. It's just something where you can establish a relationship so you can transfer what you know of the original metaphor into its object. And of course, for it to work, it has to be understood quite immediately. Otherwise, people won't get it. And so the desktop metaphor, which was the base for the interface of the Xerox Star, the original graphical user interface, was comparing and making relationships between objects you find in a regular office or desk to things that you would see on the screen. And if you remember, I should have put it back here, the picture of the interface of the Xerox Star, which was in the very first class, if you remember, black and white picture. Well, you had windows, but on the right you had icons, and one icon was looking like a mailbox, and one was looking like a printer. In current interfaces, was something looking like a trash can. So this is to evoke the real object to make you infer that this object can work sort of like the real thing. But it doesn't have to be, you know, a physical 3D simulation of a real desk. There was an interface that was done, it's called Magic Cabin, I believe, in the 90s, where they had this kind of 3D representation of a desk, and it had a telephone on the corner with a rotary thing where you had to dial numbers by turning things, and it has a Rolodex with addresses that you also had to. So this was a terrible interface, super inefficient. And it was not metaphorical, it was literal. It was trying to recreate a real desk on the screen, which of course, you know, was not easy to operate. So important thing to remember is that the desktop metaphor was created by Xerox because they were creating a machine that was targeting office secretaries that deal with, you know, drawers and memos and printers and you know, desktop objects. It's still with us today, even though a lot of things we do with computers are not necessarily related to office work. But it's very powerful because it transfers properties and actions from the physical world to these online objects, like moving something or opening it or trashing it. So again, the goal is not to simulate a real desk, but to take advantage of our knowledge of a real desk. The result of that, if we build a metaphor that works, is we save learning because we don't have to learn new things. We transfer existing things to this new world. We capitalize on external knowledge we already have, the transfer is also at the level of affordances or signifiers in the real world. You recognize something as being this or that type of object, and therefore tells us what you can do with it. And so when we build an interactive system, it's important to keep in mind that there is you, the designer, or the design team, plus the developers. You are in charge of creating this interactive system, and then there will be the user. These icons have turned weird when I moved from PowerPoint to Keynote. Strange. Now, your job is to create an interface, and to create an interface, you're going to have to define a conceptual model. So basic rules under which it operates. And then you implement this conceptual model into what Norman calls the system image. The software itself, but the system image is also the documentation that comes with it. All that. So the important point is that the only thing that the user is going to see is the system image. You see the thing on the screen, maybe you read the documentation. You guys don't read documentations, I'm sure. but it's there, sometimes you can get some help if you're stuck. And so based on this system image, you're going to build your mental model of that system. And of course, you don't build it from scratch. You build it more as an extension of mental models you have of similar tools or just of how computers operate. So the first time you, the first time you use the tablet or a smartphone, it had some familiar elements from a desktop computer and some things that are different. And then you adjust and you learn what works and what doesn't. So you build your mental model from the system image. And each one will have a slightly different mental model because we have different experiences, because we use the tools in different ways for different things. So mental model is really different for everyone. The key thing here is, will this mental model match the conceptual model that was in the heads of the designers? If it does, the users will feel like the system is easy to use, it's intuitive, it's natural, it works well, it's cool. But if there is a mismatch, they will cause a problem because people will think that something works in a certain way, but it doesn't. And that's where you get frustrated. Right? Now this is, you know, we cannot measure this match or mismatch. But the fact that each mental model is different, and the fact that you have this interaction from conceptual model through system image to the mental model is the basic reason why HCI is an empirical science. And designing interactive systems require an iterative process. You create something, you think you got the right conceptual model, you test it with users, and you realize they don't get it. Well, in many cases, you blame it on the users, but you still put the project out and you say, well, it's their problem. They'll figure it out. And yes, we are very smart. We adapt to crappy products all the time and we make it work because, you know, your job is not to like or dislike computers, but to use computers to get your job done. So people adapt to crappy system. But I think it's our responsibility as designers to try to make the best possible system. To make the best possible system, you need to know your users. Because whether you're making a product for, say you're doing a word processing system, whether you're targeting professional typographers or book designers, is not the same thing as you want a system that is targeting secretaries who are just writing 2 pages memos or things like this. They have different expectations, they have different previous knowledge, so they will build different mental models. So essentially, the iterative design loop that I talked about, again, in the first class, the goal is to try to get the best possible. It's not possible to interact with
every user.
Yes, and that's a problem. And I think in industry, the biggest problem you'll run into is how to get access to users.
I also
clear that at some point there is a cost-benefit analysis. But what I would say is that, first of all, it is important to be able to reach your users. And oftentimes, I've seen, especially from students who do internships in companies, students from this masters, you know, they go with all the stuff we taught them, and they go into the company and say, oh, can we run, you know, study with the user, etc. And companies are like, what? and some insist, and some companies are willing to, you know, play the game and see what happens, and usually have because you'll find that you'll save yourself a lot of trouble. It's amazing the number of times that a feature that you thought, you know, was critical or something, the users don't care about it. And so you can save yourself a lot of development time by deciding not just what they need, but what they don't need. Wendy worked a lot with aircraft and controllers, for example, and we had ideas for this advanced augmented reality system. The one feature that the air traffic controller said would really, really help them, air traffic controllers, they have a view of the air traffic on the radar, and they also have one, what they call strips. It's literally a strip of paper on a plastic support for each flight they are in charge of. So they have the spatial view, and they have sort of the list of flights. And they spend their time making sure that, you know, no planes are going to run into each other. That'd be good. And so they often have to match the paper strip to the little blinking dot on the radar screen. And just having a way to tap the or click the strip and see which plane it is would save them a lot of not just time, but also stress from missing something. And that was a very trivial feature to implement. And the more sophisticated stuff, they didn't seem to want to use. So I get your point about diminishing returns. And at one point you say, well, you know, we're going to have to live with it. But I think if you are in the role of designer, you always have to push for getting the right thing out. Then someone else makes a decision, well, we're going to do this or not do this. But I think that as a member of the UI team, you should always be the advocate of the user, right? But there's no, I mean, you know, this is not a class on the business of developing user interfaces. But I think there's so much that could be done at very little cost in many cases that, you know, let's get that first done, and then we can look at this type of situations. When you look, I think one problem we have, I mentioned that I think it was last week, is that we make software that has too many features. And making too many features is really abandoning the role of the designer. I think the role of the designer is to say, well, we're not going to put this in because it's not ready, because it's not really as needed as we think, but because we're going to save so much time not doing these things, we should do the things we do right. And if you look at a company like Apple, I think a big part of their success is that they are willing to put out products that are don't have all the features that people necessarily want, but the ones they have are usually better done than the competition. And then progressively they add to it, and they're also able to recognize when they're wrong, which a lot of companies are unable to do. Recognizing that, you know, something didn't work, so we're going to do it differently. And sometimes it pisses off users because they got used to the, to the inefficient way of doing the things, and now we're telling them, you know, it's different. I think the scrolling situation that we talked about last time is an interesting one. It annoyed a lot of people, but I think in the end they did the right decision. So the thing is that, yes, it's complicated. It's a multi-factor thing. But it's good to have some guiding principles, if you wish, and having this kind of tool, especially to explain to managers why something is particularly important when in their eyes maybe it is not. Because if you are able to collect data from what users are actually doing, you'll realize that there's no point in spending, you know, a lot of money on features that are used by a handful of users. But if you can save 10% of the time for the features that are used most often, that will have a real impact. Okay, so the key to me is really understanding that we're trying to get this match. Which raises the question of, well, what is the conceptual model? How do we build a conceptual model? How do we describe it? What is it? So, to me, the conceptual model is how the designer wants the user to see the system. So a conceptual model is not about the technical details of how we are going to implement this, or whether we can implement this. Although in the conceptual model, you can have things to say, well, you know, this will only work if we have a reaction time, a response time of that much for this particular feature. So it can be linked to technical requirements, but it shouldn't be at a technical level. It's fairly abstract. And in order to sort of project what the mental model in the user's heads will be, it should only talk about things that the user will be able to see in the system and to what the user will be able to do with the system. So not go into the details of how it's going to interact with this database or this backend system or this or that. It's really as seen from the user. And that refers to this notion of system image that I mentioned in the previous slides. What the user sees of the system and what is used by users to build their mental systems, mental models. And, well, this is about mental model. I think I said that before, so... Now, if you... Well, I think I'm paraphrasing myself here. If you have this correspondence, it can be improved by a proper use of metaphors, because it will help the transfer from existing knowledge. It will be improved if you take advantage of this notion of affordances and signifiers, making things evoke what they can do. And it will be improved if you follow a certain set of design guidelines. I'll show a couple of examples. And if you don't get this correspondence, and the way to think of it is the signs to detect that your conceptual model is wrong is when you see users doing manipulation errors, when you see users being frustrated, if you measure their productivity. That's a sign that not that the users are stupid, but that there's something wrong with their design. Now, it can be fixed by training users, but that's expensive, and it only works if, you know, you are doing software for a company that is willing to train users, or for complex and critical safety critical things like pilots. I don't know if you followed the story of the Boeing 737 MAX. There's now a group of pilots from Southwest Airlines are suing Boeing because Boeing didn't do the proper training on the pilots for this new system that they put in their plane to... Have you been following the... Yeah. So essentially what Boeing did is they took an old plane, they put new engines on it, but that completely changes the balance of the plane, so it's a lot less stable. So they added a system that is supposed to correct for the stability issues, but in certain circumstances, the pilots literally lose control of the plane, and there are two deadly accidents caused by that.
So the pilots didn't know how to set it up, they had no off switch for it, and that then since the
loop
read wrong readings,
and they missed. Yes. I think the so there are several issues there. There are issues with the design of the system itself, the way it was creating alarms that were telling the pilots to not do what they should be in fact doing to save the plane, and the whole training that the Boeing decided that they didn't have to do it. And it, like in every airplane accident these days, it's always multiple factors. So, trying to get back to where I was. So yeah, you can say, well, you're going to solve things by training users to use the system properly. Yes?
Designer also should have training to design system.
Oh, designers should be trained, yes, absolutely. yeah, but, you know, and the thing is, the word designer, there's different types of designs that are involved in designing interaction systems. You have the visual design and the graphic design, but you have the interaction design, and then you can have also the industrial design if you're designing a physical object. So there are many disciplines of design that are involved. Here we're talking about the interaction design and the design of the interactive system as a whole. And then there are also these specialized issues. And the problem, I think, in a lot of the industry today is, you know, people can claim themselves to be UX user experience designers just because they've taken an online course or something. There is no certification, and that's a bigger problem in the software industry. You know, everybody can claim to be a software engineer. There's no certification. In many other bodies of work, there is certification. You cannot be an architect if you don't have proper certification to build buildings. I think given the impact of software these days, the fact that there's no process to vet and also to put responsibility on people for what they do or don't do is going to be a bigger and bigger problem. So, yeah, I agree with you. Yes? As far as I know, the industry is resisting any kind of regulation, and certification is a kind of regulation. I don't think they're going to be able to do this for very much longer. I happen to be on a body. Do you know the ACM? So ACM is one of the two big societies in computers. So ACM has over 100,000 active members. The other big one is IEEE Computer Science, IEEE CS. And so I happen to be on one committee of the ACM, the Technology Policy Committee, where we're trying to educate policymakers about the risks and best practices for computing in general. These days, as you can imagine, we talk a lot about AI and the implication of AI and how to make responsible AI and fair AI and all that. At some point, our feeling is that it will have to be translated into some form of regulation. When you will have systems that make decisions for humans, say in the medical field, you know, we hear, oh, now computers are better than experts, medical doctors, at detecting whether there is a cancer based on medical analyzing a medical image. Or systems who make not decision, at least recommendation for sentencing people who are being on trial, right? But also the use of AI in things like safety critical systems, starting with autonomous cars. When these things are starting to both get it wrong, and they will, you know they will, who is going to be to blame? So, you know that there was something like a year ago, the first person killed by an autonomous car, the driver of a Tesla car, I think he was watching a video instead of paying attention to the road because the car was driving for him. Except the car mistook a passing truck for something else, and it ran into the truck, and the driver was killed. Sorry? Yeah, it thought it was the sky, but it was in fact a big white truck that was coming by. So it thought, the car thought it could go through, and it was. Now the reaction of Tesla is, we tell drivers they have to keep their hands on the steering wheel because the car is not fully autonomous. Yeah, and they tell you, it's still, given the number of miles that have been covered, da da da. But my question is, what happens when things go wrong? I don't care what happens when things go right. When things go wrong, blaming the driver for something that is completely inhumane to do, you're not going to, pay attention to the road and be ready to react to anything all the time. This is just insane. This is actually what's happening with pilots as well. A lot of things get automated. So when things get automated, you de-skill the users. You learn to drive, you take your driver's license, and then you spend 99% of your time in the driver's seat, but you have nothing to do because the car is doing it for you. And then suddenly one day, something wrong happens. Maybe the car warns you, maybe it doesn't. But if it gets an accident, it's not the fault of the people who designed the system. I think it's just not acceptable. So I think at some point we will need... There are countries, in the UK in particular, there is certification for software engineers. So I think it's going to happen probably country by country. And the reason there has been certification in other areas was to have ways to assign responsibility when something happens. So I think it will happen, but there's no, right now, it's not the industry is certainly not pushing in that direction.
I think in industry, everybody wants to put blame on
Yeah, well, we all do, we don't like to be blamed, so it's a human thing to do, but at some point, we have to, yes.
So everybody find out that another person made it.
Yeah. You were.
But isn't it counterproductive? Because if you put the blame on the designer or people that did the work, then nobody will take the risk to make something or anything.
I disagree, but yeah, she wants to say something.
Then nobody would be doctors because people die. Doctors are. But the thing is, when you are. At least in my country, when you're a doctor. You take all the dividends, and if a person dies on you, you still get kind of, you get the blame, you can save them, but it doesn't prevent you from having a job the next day. It's not like a family can sue you. I don't know if that's different here or in the US, but it would also protect, the certification would also protect people. So yeah, you have the education, even though something went wrong, it's you don't get fired.
So that's the point. Certification is both being able to admit that you can be responsible, but also being able to prove that you are not responsible for things. So it just establishes lines, and I think that saves a lot of issues about blaming it on one another. And it's true. I like your example of the medical field. I think in Europe in general, people accept that mistakes can be made and things happen. And sometimes there are bad things and people in the medical field are responsible. There's a big time chance about a drug. But when you go to the US in particular, everything is litigation. Because essentially, anybody can sue anybody for anything. And I happen to have spent 2 years living in the US. My wife Wendy tore her knee, so she had to have surgery. And it was an amazing experience because I discovered there are more people that work in medical insurance than in the medical field itself. And that tells me there's something wrong. But I won't go further because it can take us quite far. Yes?
At the end of the day, when something concerns about human life, to put some responsibility on a human, because at the end of the day, again, it's the every time it's the personal decision to drive the autonomous car, and maybe it's cruel, but if we take a look at the numbers, I think it will be much less deaths with autonomous cars than with non-autonomous cars. So I think it's a state.
Quite frankly, I don't know where this autonomous car thing is going to go. Because I think there is a lot of false hopes that are being put on autonomous cars. People who run simulations where you have majority of autonomous cars, they create, in fact, more traffic than So I think this is going to be a very long and complicated story. But the issue of blame is if I buy a car that de-skills me to the point where I don't need to drive, I cannot be at the same time held responsible if the car make a big misjudgment and creates an accident and kills me, or I would say even worse, kills someone else. But it's something where the society as a whole must decide what's right and wrong and who should be to blame. What I've seen so far is the car makers, or the one car maker that does mostly autonomous cars, doesn't want to take the blame and say, well, you have to have your hands on the wheel at all times. My brother-in-law has a Tesla, and you know he's proud that he can drive from San Francisco to wherever he goes without touching the wheel. But when there's an accident caused by the car, not by him, I don't think he would accept to be responsible for it. I'm not saying that, you know, the maker has to be, the maker of the car has to be responsible 100% of the time. We have to, again, establish where the lines are. There was another, I saw another hand raised. No? Yeah. Well, the thing is, that's where the Tesla makes a car that can drive by itself. But they tell you it's not fully autonomous. It can still make mistakes, so you have to be attentive at all times in case it does something wrong. I think this is putting a human in an impossible situation.
So
what people do is they trust the car. And then if something happens, they are held responsible because they didn't follow the
yeah, but he told that people interaction should be there in the car. If it is, we don't know. The person also don't know when what will happen. So the person
right.
should always look at the.
So the thing is, either we agree as a society that, and the same thing as with medical doctors, we agree that sometimes something will go wrong, and yes, some people will lose their lives. But on the overall, as someone was saying, we're still having less accidents than with, the current situation where everybody's driving their car. But this debate is not really happening, really. And I think there's a number of areas where companies have gotten so much power that they can sort of dictate the regulations or the absence of regulations in their best interest. But I think this is their best interest in the short run. In the long run, I think things will have to shift. But I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, I think we all want to improve our lives collectively. And yes, as we go towards more autonomous systems, the risks are going to shift. And that takes time for people to sort of get to grips with and decide what we accept. In exchange of what we gain. I think, in the area of direct impact of user interface design on people's lives and safety, I mean, you have all these medical devices that are now more and more autonomous. You know, my watch can do an electrocardiogram and call my doctor if it thinks something bad is happening. This is all nice and good, but we're getting into areas where it has to be a conversation. It's not for those companies to decide alone about what's right or wrong. That's my point. Okay. I had forgotten about this bit. Yes, remember 2000? No, I don't remember 2000. 2000, or you in 2000, you were kids. there was a selection in the US that took a long time to be decided. It's a presidential election. George W. Bush against whom? Against Al Gore. And because of the electoral system in the US, which I don't have time to get into, the whole election was going to be decided by the result of one state, Florida. In that state, it was very tight, so it wasn't decided. And then they found that weird things were happening in some counties. And one particular one was Palm Beach County, Florida. It turns out that because there were many candidates, so in the US, the way you vote, I don't know in your respective countries. In France, the way we vote is you have a set of candidates. You go to the polling place. You have one piece of paper per candidate. You're supposed to pick one of each. Go into a little, booth. And put the candidate, the piece of paper with the candidate's name in an envelope, and then you put that in the urn, and you voted. In the US, well, first of all, they have as many different systems as they have in states and counties. But in many places, they do a mechanical system to, as they say, count the votes more quickly. And so here you have one ballot, one piece of paper, and then you slide it in the machine, in a mechanical device that has this thing in the middle. And these are holes. And then you have a little... like a pencil or a little piece of metal, and you punch a hole in front of the candidate you want to vote for. And that means that after that, you put your ballot in the box, but they can count automatically, or mostly automatically. There are whole issues with the hanging chads and all that, but I won't get into this. The thing is that in this particular county, you know, most of the elections, a lot of the results can be predicted based on past elections, right? And in this particular county, it turns out that this guy, Pat Buchanan, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he is someone kind of far right spectrum, got an unexpectedly high number of votes in that particular county. Which, according to some analysts, because another particularity of the US system is they decided the result of the vote without having counted all of the votes. They figured, well, we've counted enough, the difference, you know, is good enough, we don't need to count them all. And particularly in general, they don't count the people who vote from abroad, because that's more complicated. Anyway, so the thing is, to this day, we don't know who won the election. That's the fact. People have counted and recounted and re-recounted. And anyway, but in this particular case, the result is clear that something went wrong. And the thing that went wrong is, you know, you have the top two candidates here, Bush and Al Gore. And then you have a bunch of other ones. Doesn't really matter. Most people are going to vote for the top two candidates. And so if you look at this ballot, especially if you are an old, retired person in Palm Beach, which is most of the population there, I'm afraid, they say, oh, well, I want to vote Bush, so he's the first on the list, so I push here and I'm done. If you want to vote Gore, you say, oh, here's Al Gore, it's the second one, boom, I click here. And what did you do? You voted for our friend Pat Buchanan, who didn't expect that to happen. Now, you can say, well, it's the user's fault, it's the voter's fault, it couldn't read the ballot, damn it. I mean, it's clear enough, right? Well, I think this is a little design issue. So this is known as the butterfly ballot. It got a lot of press at the time. Now here's another example that's more practical. You buy a new fridge with a freezer. And there is documentation that you take the time to look at, but it's very terse. And it says, well, you know, there's just two dials here. And here's the recommendations for various settings. Normal settings are C and 5. So C is in the middle, 5 is in the middle. Okay. Then if I want colder fresh food, which means colder food, in, colder temperature in the fridge, I go C, and here I push towards 6 and 7. And then for really the coldest, I should go even further, 8 and 9, and put this in B. Now if I want the freezer to be colder, I have to go in D and stay here. And so, well, presumably in the end you stick with C and 5 because it doesn't make sense. Now, when you buy this device, you don't know how it works. Your assumption is you have a fridge, you have a freezer. So, somehow, the mental model you're making of this thing is that one of these dials is for the fridge and the other is for the freezer. Yes?
Yes.
So that's your mental model. Right? Okay.
I feel like the answer is like, it sounds more like a type of function or mode.
A mode? Oh, yeah. But you have to make something out of it. And I think one natural model, but I agree, you know, everyone is entitled to a mental model. But one kind of natural one is that you have one, and it seems to be more the letter one that controls the freezer and more the numbers that control the fridge. Now the thing is that you bought a cheap device, and in a cheap device, there are not two compressors, there's only one. There's one unit that produces cold, and so in fact, the actual situation is that the letters control how much cold is produced by the compressor, and then the numbers decide on how it gets a split between the freezer and the and the fridge. In a sense, this is the opposite of the shower situation. You see why I'm saying it's the opposite? In the shower, you like to control independently volume and temperature, like here, amount of cold and, where it goes. Here, you want independent control. I want, like, you know, one button for the freezer, one button for the fridge. Whereas in the shower, one for the hot, one for the cold is not so good. Right. So, of course, how can you fix that? Well, you can try to do better instructions. Maybe draw this diagram to explain how it works. I think that would go a long way. In fact, you can even change the controls so they reflect how it actually works, rather than putting them like side by side, like they're in the same or similar role. But of course, you could change the controls so that you have a setting for the freezer and a setting for the fridge, and then behind the scenes it manages to turn that into the right settings for this. It's called a mapping. Which gets us to the two principles from 11 o'clock, sorry. Three principles from Norman, which are recommendations for creating good conceptual models. First one is make things visible, which you can sort of translate into the Bench-Schneiderman things on direct manipulation. You should be able to know what the state of the system is by looking at it. So don't hide things. Now, of course, if the state is complex, it means you may have too many things to display, so then there's some design to make to fix that. The second is super important, is this mapping principle, is to make explicit the relationships between actions and results, controls and their effects, the state of the system, and what is visible. Mental models are about relationships. If I do this, I expect that to happen. If I see this, it means that. So you want to make these relationships either explicit by showing them, or building on metaphors so that people will infer them and they will match their expectation. And a big way to make the mapping more efficient is by using feedback. Feedback to tell the user what's going on, what the system thinks the user is trying to do. So feedback about what the user is doing. Feedback also includes what we call feed forward, indicate what the user can do in a certain situation. I like these three principles because they are quite high level, but they are also quite practical. Making things visible, tell the user what the system thinks he or she is doing, and understand what the mappings are. I'm going to stop here for today because we've gone on some tangents and I've lost time. So tomorrow we'll see the longer list. And we'll go into how we actually build those mental models. Any last pressing questions? No? Okay, well, you're ready to conceptualize then. Starting with a break, I assume, Rafael?
Today. So, we'll let you fight for the break. We've got a lot of things to do, and we need you to have the time to do it. So, at 11:07.